Hi, my name is Ilona Thompson with Palette Exposure, and we're here in Windsor, California, with Titian Karkus, chef owner of Tisa Bistro. It's nice to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here with us.
You have quite an unusual background. I've followed you since Meritage Resort in Napa Valley, and I know that your food is very, very special. I want to delve into your background a bit. Where did it all begin? Tell us about your birthplace, your early inspirations, how did you get into food? I want to know it all.
Okay. I was born in Hungary. I'm Hungarian. I was born in Hungary. Back in then, there was behind the Iron Curtain, Russian occupied Hungary. I born into a family with my father was an artist, and he painted beautiful murals, and I think for some part of his life he, you know, like every artist is somewhat insane, you know, level of insanity required to be an artist, and
absolutely,
and my basically our family was very traditional. My grandmother come from the villages, and they used to farmers, and they always had good meal at the table. That was very, very important. We always had the Sunday dinners or lunches, and then when most of the time we always had the consomme, like a hand consomme, like, you know, when they did the chicken soup, the American chicken soup. Actually, it's when they the best fit was always not a chicken, they for the old hens, because it take a long time to cook. So there is much better flavor those older chickens have.
Patient food, it's slow food.
Yeah, like I remember my grandma used to have, like, she get up on Sunday like really early, and then he had the stove in the kitchen, and then he or she always said when they cook the chicken and the hen, and they always say this, when it's boiling, it's not boiling, it's curdling. So when the fat was, you know, the boiling, okay, it's just like a little pulse coming up to the top of the soup. So that was just like, the soup has to be like it sounds weird because I translated from Hungarian to English, but it's create a pulse, you know, and then it's cooked like 4 or 5 hours. And I remember she handmade the very thin pasta. It's almost like an angel hair pasta, but even thinner. And then she folded the dough, and then she had a knife, she cut the dough with a knife. So she used to have a cutting board, and then the cutting board had like an indentation, so like it wasn't flat, because she always cut the pasta in the same spot. So eventually, after years, there was like have a little like a well in it. So,
wow.
So it was always very important, the food, and you know, like there was like something like you have lunchtime, you have to sit down for lunch. If you don't sit down for lunch, you're not gonna get eat. What? Not like that, but even like, if you don't want to eat, you still have to sit down for lunch. Like, you have to sit there and don't eat, you know, your kids, and like, I don't want to sit down, I want to do this, but we have to sit down. And so back to that hand consomme, we had, so obviously they cooked the hen, and you first you eat the broth with the fresh cooked pasta in it, you know, the very thin pasta. And then, you know, remember we always liked that, like, I have a lot of pasta, sometimes we do a little pasta. And also the meat course, there's always was the meat of the hen. So they put them in a bowl, in a, like a big porcelain vessel, and then they usually make either like a rich tomato sauce with it, or I think it's boysenberry with a green stripe. I think boysenberry sauce, so very tart and tangy, and then
gooseberry maybe.
No, boysenberry.
Really?
Yeah. And then maybe gooseberry. Yeah. And then we usually, that was your second course, and the third course was either like, you know, schnitzel or fried chicken, or, you know, depends on what was the season, you know. Then, you know, every season had its own meals, and every holiday had its own dishes. So it's played very important part of life, like what you eat. You know, I remember you cannot buy strawberries in summer. I mean, in winter.
Yes.
So there was no strawberries in winter and so forth. So you when you try to please your family during the winter, you have to get creative. So that's what other chefs, creativity, I think Europe come from, this older world, but when you were, I worked in beautiful restaurants in Budapest, and I remember the chef has to like crack their head you know, during the winter time, so what we're gonna cook, because they have to make the week, they used to write weekly menu. So that was with handwritten, with a carbon copy on top of each other, you know? and then it was just something, you know, when those scarce times became, required more creativity from the chef.
Ingenuity.
Mm-hmm. And then, so that's what you come, your quince, your chestnuts, your, you know, your potatoes, what you can create with potatoes, simple items, you know, carrots, you know? It's just, I think that's what's missing a little bit of today's cooking. We're not forced to live with the nature, because we can buy raspberries in January. That's
sure.
For us, it's still today. If you go back to Hungary and tell my friend, like, oh, you guys want to, now you can buy a strawberry, raspberry in January. We come from Spain or
sure.
North Africa or whatever, but general public still don't buy it because it doesn't taste like when the real
strawberries,
the real summer strawberries. They're so accustomed to that quality of flavors of the fruit and vegetable products, just you can't really sell for general public. I think it's something like a curiosity, something just a fancy things, you know, to enjoy, maybe indulge in it. But mm-hmm. but I remember like 2 years ago I went to my mother's pantry, and then Hungary famous from because we have perfect climate for peaches and apricots. The Hungarian apricot is very famous. And then I remember we went to her pantry and she had a basket. She always has a pantry, like a separate pantry when she stores all your jars, and you know, they preserve during the summertime when you have so much fruit, they preserve them, and then they make jams and they, you know, whatever they do with it. And then I remember she had a basket of apricots. And then I just, you know, I was here, I mean, even in the United States, you get used to see these perfect fruits and good looking. And then this apricots was like, looked like almost the size of a, if you know what an almond looked like in a shell,
mm-hmm.
like unshelled almond, like a little, like a little hard, little like they wasn't not appealing to the eyes,
mm-hmm.
but I bite into them and there was just an orchestral flavors, just
my mouth is watering.
Like exploded, you know, like when you know, we went to wine tasting, you know, a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
with you, and then you introduced me some wine. It's just like you know, some of the wines just your give your mind and go into a journey.
Yes.
Like all these levels of flavor, complexity goes into it. And I was just dumbfounded as a chef in my mother's pantry to have these gorgeous apricot, the ugly apricot, but essentially when you have, when you have, she had to make a tart with it, she literally, that apricot, you have to do nothing with it. It's a sin even do anything with it. Just put on your tart and just bake it, and then your apricots will do the work.
Wow. So clearly you gleaned a ton of inspiration by what you were surrounded by growing up and watching your grandma cook in the kitchen every day and produce this mouth-watering dishes. Literally from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that had to influence you a great deal.
It does. Yeah, I think my mother was more influential, but essentially, I always searched. You know, when I was growing up, chef, I always went from trying to different style of cooking,
mm-hmm.
and then I somehow we always bended back to what I come from.
Oh.
So this is what we come in the full circle with Tisa. So it's kind of like I was thinking about, like, you know, when the chefs try to, like, we all try to belong somewhere or somehow belong something, you know,
and then
I think what we embrace here and what, how we come full circle with the restaurant, I do not want it to be follower or be somebody else. I try to go back to the experiences, and you know, I recommend it for all the chefs to try to go back where he comes from, because that's when your food comes from, that heart, you know.
Absolutely.
you pour that soul to it, it's make you original, make you different than anybody else.
No, it's so true. Embracing your background and really translating it, I think that's what sets you apart so much. I want to dive for just a moment into your culinary background. I know you worked in some really illustrious restaurants around the world while you're honing your skill set. So tell us about that.
Okay, I went to culinary school. A lot of this inspiration I got from from my family, and then actually my mother. Finally, I think that was the final draw to start culinary school in Hungary. But the start culinary school, I used to work when you're a student in Europe, you have to work 1 week working in a real kitchen, and one week you cook in the school, and I used to work for that school of Grand Hotel Astoria Budapest, one of those, you know, 18th century old world kitchens. That's when I grew up, and then eventually I went to work for the chef in Europe. His gorgeous kitchen was first time I started there. It's like copper pans and it's very old world, like railings and pots, and you will see it in a cartoon, you know, like you see like in a Julia Child world, you know. That's where we grew up. And by age of 24, I was called the rising star. Mm-hmm. And then I won some competition in cooking, so I have a chance to go work with Paul Bocuse. That was the first prize to win this, you know, young cooks competition.
Yes.
So first and second place had a internship with Paul Bocuse. So I traveled a lot. I felt the urge to explore different things around the world. The culinary was always my culinary skills was always like a common language between continents and people and worlds, and it was just so easy. And then I just love to be in just travel around the world, and I still find today a great connection with when I met with people with different background to experience how they live, what they eat, you know, whatever. We travel different countries. I love to go to grocery stores, so I love to see what people buy. Every country I have to go to grocery store whenever I travel, just want to see what's available, what people buy, how's everything look, and just kind of have a sense through that the culture I am in.
Wow.
And then later on I came to America on and off. I used to work for JW Camelback in this iconic resort in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, and then eventually I drifted to California. I worked a couple of like very prestigious private clubs, and eventually I got to Napa Valley through that round, and make my way up to north, and then about a year and a half ago we opened Tissa Bistro, and then we bring in this old world feeling, what I just described earlier, with try to merge it with the current wine country we can afford for us in here, the produce wise, and kind of translate it into a different meaning, a different cuisine.
Sure.
You know, rooted in our past.
You know, I know you've done quite a bit of fine dining, and clearly it's evident from everything you've described that you have exceptional curious mind in addition to a stellar skill set. You and I had a short conversation prior to the taping that I would like to bring up, because I think it's fundamental to who you are, and that's the fact that you have experienced very early on what it's like to live frugally and what it's like to utilize everything. These days, a lot of chefs talk about cooking from nose to tail, and you know, really utilizing the animal and living from the land and taking it as far as they want. You know, foraging is a big deal. We've discussed that. But to you, it's an integral part of who you are and your beginnings. That I think played a huge role in forming the opinions of how to cook and what is the chef's point of view. And that is that acute awareness that what you have to work with, that maybe all you have, you create the best value out of those ingredients. So I just want you to talk a bit about that, because I think, you know, in the contemporary world and you know, the way that things are, we have a lot of access to things. We're pretty spoiled in society. But it's not like that everywhere, and it certainly wasn't the case for you.
Yeah, we always thought that there was great value to work when you're available. And but plus they always tasted the best. Mm-hmm. But we always cooked. Essentially, I think everything's comfortable. Like I love to eat.
Yeah.
I just love to eat. I love to eat good food.
That's
good. And then it's getting getting harder and harder. You know, so as I mentioned earlier, I come from a very humble background in Hungary. So it was, you know, always a good eat or some special treat was always the highlight. You know, many times I talk to my folks, like, you know, when we had, you know, for example, when we had certain food, we had certain attached to certain holidays.
Sure.
So like Christmas was always duck, you know, that's or like a special occasion when we had veal was something luxury. You know, we talk about like a Wiener Schnitzel made out of veal, but in a true everyday nature is never made out of veal. So in our life, that was the highlight. That's made it magic, these holidays. You know, there was something we look forward to. Then I feel many of these younger culture, not the younger cultures, but I feel it's missing out of our cultures.
Yes.
To looking forward to holiday. Christmas comes. That was filled with our food, and it's translated into some level of magic. So you know, when I remember, like, you know, I tell you a funny story, but you know, it might be make curious from your listeners, but I remember when my grandma used to kill the goose. You know, we have roasted goose. You know,
okay.
To Christmas, that was something I remember, like the gold, the roasted goose, and we just can't wait. The kitchen filled with the smell of the. And remember when she killed the goose? You cut the neck of the goose and you bleed them out. So when we were kids, my grandma used to get the blood of the goose, and then she sauteed onions, like when you kill the goose right away, and she collected the blood of the goose.
Sure.
And then she pan fried onions, and then you saute the blood with the onions.
Okay.
And then we for us for that was a treat for our kids.
Wow.
So
you want that?
Yeah.
Treat for kids.
so it meaning us, you know, that it was really important for us to these holidays, and you know, there was we grow certain appreciation to things.
Yeah.
And then it was not the everyday common things available for us. So that's comes through our cuisine, and then those days was really, really marvelous.
Absolutely. I'm hearing a great deal of attachment, and I can almost picture in my mind what it was like.
Yeah.
You know, we complain, and justly so, that our holidays became way too materialistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're looking forward to opening some boxes and not to talk to each other, not to wake up to this atmosphere of generosity and goodwill overflowing.
Yeah.
And I think that's it ought to be about.
Yeah, I think it's best to have it. It's, you know, sometimes like I'm getting older and older, can I get away from these materialistic things. I feel like I need less and less. Only I need a couple good friends and a good meal to share with them. It's really what it is, and you know, and then what truly makes me happy is like travel. Travel, see other people's culture, how they live, but really, it's just, you know, I think the food is tremendously connecting us.
Yes.
You know, it's a common language, this is what we do here, just very simple cooking. Happiness, food and eating is something, you know. I always thought about what is food.
Yeah.
Food is home.
Food is home.
Food is happiness. Food is comfort.
Indeed.
Something you get away from the world, and then warm your soul.
Yes. Those are not only beautiful words. You back it up. When I first ate in your restaurant, I couldn't wipe the smile off my face. And for context, I eat pretty well in my profession. And to experience something that was so authentic, it wasn't just a term. It really came from someplace deep within you. I believe I mentioned it was like having you on a plate. because it's not just a menu composed of dishes that are, you know, well executed. It really showed me that, without knowing as detailed of a history as you just shared with us, thank you for that, that you came from a place where you wanted to feed people and you wanted for people to be happy and to have this experience as if they're sitting in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And having a conversation. Yeah. And that type of facilitating is rare.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so thrilled that you're here and that you have this restaurant, because people that discover it, they become repeat clients and clients. And I could clearly see why. Because your menu is something that's absolutely craveable. Tell us more about it. Let's dig into how you've written the menu, why the dishes that are on it are on it. How did you put it together?
The dishes, every dish on the menu has some sort of idea or story attached to it. They just not just grab from thin air, so I can tell every dish a little bit some how they get here. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit personal. I think it's very personal we put in the menu.
Great.
We like to, I have lots of traditional dishes, which I've been cooking for a long time, and I really, really like to share with our guests, because that's ultimately, that's why we are here, to create and make you happy. I think that's why we are here. Like, I love to see when guests leaves happy, you know, like last night we had a full restaurant and it really had like just such a good vibe. Every table loved everything, and you know, we serve these little cheese biscuits, you know, for everyone. This kind of an amuse-bouche or whatever you call it, you know, and it's made out of farmer's cheese, and literally it's my mother's recipe. I stole it from her. Because we try to get like a first, you know, we come, you know, try to do some pretty rolls or something with like, you know, rosemary and sea salt and whatever, and then, you know, the baker doesn't really, was too flexible to do that, so just like, okay, we have to come up with something.
Yeah.
And we just whipped it out, we made like a farmer's cheese, and then just some of them, they want to take it to home, and they want to buy it more of that,
and then you created a monster
that
I have to keep making it.
Yeah, it is. And also we like to, of course, you know, play around with the ingredients and different things, you know, like we had octopus, which is not Hungary, it has nothing to do with Hungary, you know, but I combined, I tried to fuse them with the Hungarian ideas, like a Hungarian sausage in octopus. This comes the idea from a lot of people, so with chorizo with octopus. So that's our translation, you know, in that chorizo idea. Then also it's expand, because serving for the sauce grebiche, because that's come from Escafier.
Yes.
So that the turn of a century, he made that basically that sauce. You know, I always adorn Escafier, because all these styles and trends that comes rise and fall, but yeah, Escafier is always he's whatever he brought to us is always still existing. And then it's timeless.
I can attest to the fact that when I met Christian for the first time back in Napa Valley, I walked into your office and that's the first thing I saw. I saw a very well-worn tome by Escoffier with lots of notes and post-its, and you read that book many times. It was quite evident.
Yeah, I get a lot of critique. It's like they call me like a dinosaur, you know, because, you know, we are looking to the you know, modern cuisine, but I think we have to balance it a little bit. That's what I'm trying to do with this. So we have octopus, which is sous vide, an octopus, it's cooked in a vacuum bag, basically in a temperature controlled environment, and then it's served with a turn of the century sauce. So I just, you know, it's some of the experimental ideas, you know. A couple other dishes. We have a spätzle. We made a spätzle, which is not necessarily German. We call them galushka. So there is, you know, Europe, Central Europe is kind of intervening and swirling into different cuisine, but somewhat they're a little bit correlated to each other. Like there is no really borders of of those cuisines. So the kangalushka, then we have a translation of the American spetzel mac, but we it's made out with a spetzel. And then you put mushroom oil and bacon and just really the warm, the flavor, the smokiness, the cheese melting, you know, with dozens of cheeses. It's baked in a cast iron dish, you know, it's really lovely. And then, you know, we also it comes along with the Wiener Schnitzel, which is not a hot dog. you know, Wiener Schnitzel is a cutlet of Vienna.
Yes.
And then we, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's traditionally made with veal, but the general household are made with pork, or sometimes even with chicken, and then that's probably our biggest thing. So it's biggest item, the most popular item in the menu, and then you know, we took us a quite good amount of time to figure out how to write, about 6 to 8 months, how to figure it out, how to make it really properly, because it's true the dish is pan fried. And then I remember, like in Europe, some of the old cuisine have like a big flat top, and they have like a heavy cast iron dish sitting on that French top, and then they finish this for like 20 minutes in like lard, you know, the lard, you know, forget about, you know, the lard is that's what makes it real. The flavor, that's yes. That, you know, the butter and oil has no flavor, you know, but the butter has butter. But the oil doesn't have the flavor, so they said, you know, they cooked it in lard, which is, you know, Wiener Schnitzel eventually came across in a different culture for a Japanese, they call them tonkatsu, and they translated it. And then I used to live in Japan, so my time is, you know, where all the chefs fry it. Basically, the real tonkatsu in Japan is fried in lard. Usually, every chef has their own blend of oil, like his own secret components, how many this, how many that, blended together, just fried. But that's our biggest item, the Wiener Schnitzel. That's the most popular, and we try to get as authentic as we can. But even some days, I find it is still hard. So, you know, something seems very simple, but then you dwell into the details, and then, you know, your expectation of yourself is fall apart because just you realize how many different ways you can go. Like if you look at it, just try to perfect something, and just every little steps count, you know, how you get to that product. So it's a good experience. So but definitely the Wiener Schnitzel is big, and then we do a couple of chicken dishes and Malvai mushroom cognac sauce, which I will cook it later. And,
I didn't warn you folks, it's a bit unfair. This episode was supposed to be getting to know Christian. But we got into food, and if you're hungry right now, this is really difficult because I had lunch, and listening to him describe how brilliant and flavorful the dishes are, I'm starving. But what really is special about every single thing that I've ever tasted that was made by your hands is that in addition to just crazy delicious flavors, you feel like you're getting such a huge value. I mean, not only it's a very generous place of food, but it's, you know, it's well priced, and you just want to keep eating, even when you're full. I've never really had that level of generosity in any other dining establishment.
I think it's connects a little bit of to our culture, how. Because we come from this humble background we talked about earlier. So if my job, if you're your guest, to fill you up. Does that make sense?
It makes so much sense.
You know, that's I have to satisfy you. I don't want you to leave you unhappy or not fully.
I don't think you could if you tried.
And then I think it's part of this, you know, this idea how we try to please through generosity,
like
good food, and then something, every dish with a menu we personally love to eat, we cook it at home, we cherish it, and you know, sometimes we experiment, but it comes full circle with our past.
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. So there you have it. If you want to be happy and satisfied, head over to Tisa and Beware, it gets full really quickly. It's a very popular spot. In our next episode, Christian will teach us how to cook a really kick-ass chicken in Koinerik sauce. I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you for watching, and please send us questions for Christian.